Good morning, everybody. Are we happy to be alive? Yeah. Amen. It is good to be here, and I am turning off my ringer on my phone right now. So maybe, it is good to be here. And I tell you, if you were here yesterday, you were enriched. Amen. And for those unable to make it, we have several more sessions with our brother Kyle Butt. And we're so glad that God has given us this opportunity. I've said time and time again to the church that I grew up with Apologetics Press. We would often in the Kansas City area invite him out with one church, and then another church would invite someone from Apologetics out, and they would just go all around metropolitan Kansas City, and my dad and mom brought me to every single one of them, it seemed. And they were always reading material in the back, and my folks would pick that up for me. I'd pick up all the free stuff, and that just truly impacted me and really set a fire in me. And so I encourage you to do the same for the young people you know, and even for yourself. Our brother Kyle here is doing a fantastic service for God as he works with Apologetics Press, and you can tell that he has studied and that he is well prepared. And you will be benefited for being here. And one last thing, as we were talking late last night, he is a proud man in so many ways. He's got a great family, and he says that he comes from a state, Alabama, one of the few places on this earth where you have an undefeated football team. So this is good. I now turn it over to him.
We were going to be talking about theistic evolution. Now we're going to be talking about lying. This is a statement that you would expect to see. Let me see if I can get it up here from the PowerPoint. I thought we had it going. I can quote it for you. I'd rather you read it, though. Come on. Good to see you this morning. I'm going to have to tell you my last joke. I only got one left. A couple guys go into the middle of the woods, and I see a big hole in the middle of the woods floor. There we go. Hold on. Now you can't look at it. Now I'm in the middle of my joke. They go into the woods, and they see a big hole in the middle of the woods floor, and they think, I wonder how deep that hole is. And they decide they're going to find the bottom of that hole, so they look around, find some gravel-sized rocks, toss them in there. Don't hear them hit the bottom. So they think, well, we've got to have some bigger rocks. And they find a baseball-sized rock or two. They throw those in there and listen. And they don't hear those hit the bottom. So they think, well, we've got to have something bigger. So they look around and there's a railroad tie in the middle of the woods. Now, I don't know why it doesn't dawn on them that this is odd. But they think, hey, if this hole has a bottom, this railroad tie will find it. So one of them gets on one side. The other one gets on the other side. They heave in the hole and they shove this railroad tie into the hole. About 5 seconds later, this wild-eyed, crazy goat comes running through the woods, jumps up in the air, and shoots down the hole. I don't know what in the world's going on. About 5 minutes later, a farmer is walking through the woods, and you can tell he's looking for something, and they say, hey, what you doing? He says, well, I'm looking for my goat. Have you seen him? They say, yeah, we saw your goat about 5 minutes ago. The wild-eyed, crazy goat came running through the woods, jumped up in the air about 8 feet, and shot down this hole. The farmer said, no. He said, that can't be my goat. He said, my goat's chained to a railroad tie. All right. Back to business here. Charles Smith made a statement that goes like this. In the beginning was matter, which begot the amoeba, which begot the worm, the fish, the amphibian, the reptile, the lower mammal, which begot the lemur, which begot the monkey, which begot the man who imagined God. This is the genealogy of man. This is exactly what you expect from an atheistic evolutionist. From someone who does not believe that there is a God, from someone who does not believe that God created humans in His image, this is the standard atheistic teaching, and it's exactly what you expect to hear and to see from unbelievers. It's not, however, what you expect to hear from people who claim to be Christians. And that is the point of discussion where we are this morning. There is the idea that somehow the atheistic, materialistic, scientific community has struck upon something that Christians need to adopt as well and somehow find a way to fit it into the Bible. And so what you will see is statements like this being made by people that claim to be Christians, that claim to believe in the Bible, but that follow this atheistic line of teaching all the way down to the amoeba evolving into a human. Let me illustrate that for you. This is a poster that in pictorial form says exactly what Charles Smith's statement says in words. You have the single cell amoeba going into the worm, and then to the fish, then to the amphibian, the lizard, the lemur, the monkey, the man. And this poster was on the side of one of the science buildings of one of the universities associated with the Lord's Church. Now, generally speaking, I don't say which one. I don't know if this is still there. I don't know what professors were teaching this or not. But this was at a school that we would associate with the Lord's Church on the side of the science classroom wall, with no explanation, no idea that, hey, this is not the case, this is not what we're really teaching. That was just there. And this is not an isolated event. In fact, Lucy, maybe you've heard of her. Lucy is supposed to be one of our primate ancestors. Now, we've done much to show that Lucy was not one of our primate ancestors. In fact, Lucy was not most likely even a female. This particular specimen probably should be called Larry, and Larry was certainly not a primate ancestor of humans. Larry was little more than a knuckle-walking ape, and so if you were just to analyze the bones and the alleged fossil evidence for human evolution from primates, it's got all kinds of holes. But I show this to say that we were talking to one young lady from another university associated with the Lord's Church who said she was in a cultural anthropology class in the evenings, and her professor explained to her in the class that they all evolved from lower animals and that Lucy was one of their relatives and that they needed to believe this, and this was the truth. And as you think about Lucy supposedly being one of our relatives, you understand that that's running into some serious problems with what the book of Genesis teaches us. So whereas we would expect a person who's an atheist to say, yeah, in the beginning was matter, matter begot the amoeba, all the way up to humans, we would not expect to hear that from someone who says, I believe in God, I believe that the Bible is God's Word, and I believe that God created everything. As we think about this idea, there is something upon which every person in the discussion agrees, and that is this. When Charles Darwin suggested his idea that evolution was responsible for bringing into existence every living organism that is on the earth today and was in 1859, Charles Darwin said, I recognize that you've got to have time to do this. In Charles Darwin's day, he said you needed about 200 million to 400 million years. You see, that was back when they called the cell the simple cell. That was when they thought that the cell was a blob of protoplasm, much like a blob of jello, that there were no serious, complex mechanical interactions involved in the cell, and basically it was more like a building block than anything else. And he thought, yeah, 200 to 400 million years would get it. Well, we've looked at nature much more closely since 1859, and even the evolutionists themselves admit that 200 to 400 million years just isn't going to get what you need. In fact, they say now you need 4.5 billion years. And of course, you know what a billion is. A billion is 999 million years, 999,000, etc., plus one. So it's 1,000 million years. So now they suggest to us that we need 4,500 million years. And even that, the fact of the matter is, time is just not going to give them what they need. But everybody recognizes, here's what everybody recognizes. You've got to have time if you ever even want to suggest evolution is true. And so, a person will come to the book of Genesis and they will say, yes, I know that Genesis says in 6 days, that Exodus 20:11 says in 6 days God made the heavens, the earth, and all that's in them. And Genesis 1 says on day 1 God made light, and day 2 He made the firmament, day 3 the flowers, grass, and trees. But, they will say, we can fit the billions of years into the book of Genesis. Well, and when they start thinking about trying to do that, the question arises, where are you going to fit billions of years? Now notice you don't need millions. You know, if each day was 1 million years, guess what? Wouldn't do you a lick of good. If each day was 10 million years, guess what? Wouldn't do you one lick of good. If you're an evolutionist, if you suggest that evolution took place, God maybe started it and evolution took over, you need 4.5 billion years. Well, now let me step back. You need 4.5 billion years right now. What I mean by that is the average age of the earth in the atheistic evolutionary community doubles every 40 years. So see, in Charles Darwin's day, you needed 200 to 400 million years. And so people found a way to shove that in the Bible. Well, and then later you needed 1 billion, and so people found a way to shove that in the Bible. And then later you needed 3 billion, so they shoved that in the Bible. And then you needed 4.5 billion, which is where we are now. Guess what? In 40 years, 4.5 billion is not going to touch it. If everything goes according to how the standard average has been, you're going to need 9 billion. And then guess what? In another 40 years, if they keep holding on to the theory of evolution, which if we look at how things have gone in the past, they might just get rid of it and pull something else in, but you're going to have to double it every 40 years. So where would you put this time? Well, some people would try to put it before the creation, but the most common idea is attempting to put the time during the week of creation. Now, when I say before, here's where some people try to put it. In Genesis 1:1, they say that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and then there's a gap of 4.5 billion years, and Genesis 1:2 takes over. It's called the gap theory. We've got that discussed. Generally speaking, the man in the pew has never really heard much about the gap theory, and it's something that's rather technical. And we can deal with it. If I have time, I'll deal with some of it this morning. But generally speaking, the idea that most people have heard about how evolution might could be fit into the Bible is, well, what about those days? I mean, couldn't God have created the world in any amount of time He wanted? Couldn't those days be millions or billions of years, unidentified long expanses of time? That is something called the day age theory. The idea that the days are not literal 24-hour periods, but they are ages, long extended expanses of time. Now understand this. If you're going to suggest that, then there again, you don't need the days to be 1,000 years. You don't need the days to be 100,000 years. You don't need them to be 1,000,000 years. You've got to have days that are almost 1 billion years apiece. So if you're going in your mind to say, well, yeah, the days could have been longer than a day, well, understand what you mean by longer. You're meaning 1,000,000,000 years longer. And as we go through this, I think what you're going to see is that this idea of billions of years is just simply not needed. Now, lots of people will go to 2 Peter chapter 3. Verse 8, and they'll say, yeah, well, doesn't 2 Peter explain to us that one day is as 1,000 years to the Lord, and 1,000 years is as one day? Well, let's look at a little context here. You'll probably recall that this is in the middle of Peter explaining to people that Jesus Christ is coming back. And Jesus Christ hasn't come back yet during Peter's time. And the people who are looking at the situation are saying, you know what, God made this promise a long time ago. And I wonder if God's promise is still any good. You know how sometimes humans make a promise and we forget over time and we let our promise lapse and we don't do what we should do because it's been so long ago. Well, what Peter is saying is, guess what? God doesn't forget when He made a promise. And so if He made the promise yesterday, it's just as powerful as if He made it 1,000 years ago. And if He made it 1,000 years ago, it's just as powerful as if He made it today. So the context here certainly is not talking about the days of creation. It's talking about if God makes a promise, it's good any time. But notice what I think is so very interesting. Number one, this says, with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years. Does this say one day is 1,000 years? You know what the word as there is? As is a word that tells you an analogy, but is not giving you an equation. What I mean by that is, if you were to watch the fog come in, and you said, the fog rolls in as a cat creeping up on its prey. What are you doing there? Well, you're not saying the fog is a cat creeping up on its prey. You're giving an analogy there. So this doesn't say one day is 1,000 years and 1,000 years is one day. It says it is as one. Now watch this. Here's what else I find very interesting here. In this particular verse, God's trying to communicate two periods of time. What are they? 1,000 years and a day. Now, does God know how to communicate the difference between 1,000 years and a day? Yes, He does, and that's exactly what He's doing in this particular context. So, when God says one day, what's He talking about? Well, in this context, He's talking about a 24-hour period, is as 1,000 years. What's He talking about when He says 1,000 years? 1,365-day years. So, you understand that God can communicate the difference between a day and 1,000 years. Now, when you start reading the description of God's creative activity, there's something that doesn't bear the whole weight of the argument, but it's certainly something that you need to discuss. And that's simply the fact that when God says something, it looks like it just happens. It doesn't look like God says it and then 9 million years later or 1 billion years later it happens. It looks like God says it, boom, it happens right when He says it. If you were looking at Psalm 33, 6 and 9, by the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of His mouth. For He spoke, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast. And then you have God commanded, and they were created. Here is what we know about the way that the word day is used in the Bible. It's used in lots of different ways. And you guys understand that the only way to come to a real understanding of a word is the context of the word. For instance, if I were to ask you what the word bear means, B-E-A-R, what does bear mean? Oh, well, that'd be kind of difficult to nail down unless you had some context, wouldn't it? If I said I was chased by a big brown bear, I think you'd understand that what we're talking about then. What if I said the emotional load was too heavy for him to bear? It's a homographic homophone, spelled the exact same way, sounds the exact same way, and yet now we have a totally different meaning. What if I said the burden of bricks was too heavy for the young boy to bear? Now we even have a different meaning a little bit there on the third bear. So you understand that context is exactly what you need. In the Bible, it is true that the word day is used several different ways. In fact, if you were to sit down and think through these, you would know this to be the case. You've seen lots of these. The opposite of night. You remember when Jesus said, I must work while it is day. The night comes when no man can work. What's He saying? Opposite of night. Easy to understand. It's an approximate period of 12 hours when it's light, an approximate period of 12 hours when it's dark. I work while it's light and I sleep when it's dark because that's the order of things here in the first century. We don't have electricity. Okay, everybody understands that. Now, you know that if you went to Alaska, that sometimes it might be light for 20 hours and dark for 4 hours, but everybody understands what the general statement here is. I work while it is day, the opposite of night. Easy to understand. Now you've got a period of time in the future. Think through this. When have you ever heard the word day used to be an unspecified time in the future? But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. Well, how long is that going to be? The 24-hour period of the Lord? Well, no. All that's talking about is an unidentified, unspecified period of time in the future. So you've got opposite of night, unspecified time in the future, the total days of creation. I don't know if you've read Genesis chapter 2, about verses 1 through 3, but the Bible says this is the creation of the world on the day that God made it. Well, you've got the word day there talking about the whole 7-day creation week. And then you have, finally, a literal day. Now, generally speaking, the word day, yom, in the Old Testament is used to mean a literal day, most all the time. Sometimes it means these other things, but most of the time it means a literal 24-hour day. But our question would simply be this. Is there any way from the Old Testament that you can tell what the days of Genesis are? Is there any context? Is there anything that's going to help you see what these are? Because what we've established is God can tell you the difference between 1,000 years and a day if He wants to. He knows how to do it. So how could He have done that in Genesis chapter 1? Let me begin by explaining to you the concept of evening and morning. You'll recall in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and He said, "Let there be light," there was light, and He divided light from the darkness, and the light He called day, the darkness He called night, an evening and a morning, day one. There is not a period of time that is identified as an evening and a morning in non-prophetic literature that ever means anything other than a literal 24-hour day. Now let me stop you right there, and if you're thinking through this with me, you're looking at that and saying, "What non-prophetic literature, what does that mean?" Well, you understand what prophetic literature is. Isaiah, Jeremiah. Non-prophetic literature, like Genesis and Exodus, this is historic narrative. In fact, I have not talked to a single person in all of the discussion that claims that Genesis 1 is prophecy. Nobody does. Because it's obviously not. It's a description of something that happened in the past. It is not prophetic literature. So you've got 100 examples of the phrase evening and morning, and every single time it's used in non-prophetic literature, it always means a literal 24-hour period. You understand that that means if these days of Genesis were not literal 24-hour periods, it would be a brand new grammatical construction that no one has ever seen in the existence of the Hebrew language. It would be totally new. And that's just with the phrase evening and morning. If we were to say, how could Moses, writing through inspiration, have ensured that whoever read this understood these to be literal 24-hour days, the first thing that we would say is, well, he would use the phrase evening and morning. What else would he do to ensure that whoever was reading this would think that these were literal 24-hour days? Well, there's something else he would do. He would explain to us that in the process, if these days were long extended periods of billions of years, you would have just some pragmatic problems. For instance, Genesis chapter 1, verse 9 and 10, 11, 12, 13 right there, this is a discussion of plants. God makes plants on day 3. If a morning is a long extended period of millions of years, and then there is an evening when things are dark and the sun is not around, when the light that God created on day 1 is not around, if it's a long black time, well, what's going to happen to plants that are created in the morning of day 3 and there be a long extended period of dark black time on day 3? Well, they're going to die, aren't they? You're going to have serious problems with the biology involved here. And so, the grass, flowers, and trees that God makes on the morning of day 3 are somehow going to have to live until day 4. And if there's a long extended period of darkness that is called evening of billions of years or millions, well, then you're going to have some biological problems. And there's another situation that we just need to stop right here and discuss. And that's the fact that if you're going to look at the standard evolutionary teaching, like in the beginning, matter begot the amoeba, and the amoeba begot the worm begot the fish, etc. That sequence does not correspond to what Genesis says happened. For instance, according to the evolutionary community, dinosaurs, land-living dinosaurs, evolved into birds. On what day were dinosaurs created? Day 6, if they're land-living animals. On what day, according to Genesis, were birds created? So, if you're looking at the biblical sequence, you've got dinosaurs on day 6 that the evolutionary community says evolved into birds, and yet you've got birds being created on day 5 before the dinosaurs. Let me give you another example. Flowering plants When were they created according to Genesis 1? Day 3. According to the theory of evolution, flowering plants did not come into existence until long after most of the animals in the ocean, the swimming creatures. When were the swimming creatures created? Day 5. So you've got flowering plants being created before lots of the swimming creatures in Genesis that were created on day 5. So according to evolution, when should the flowering plants have come? Well, they should have come after day 5 somehow, on day 6, and yet they came on day 3. So you literally could take hundreds and hundreds of examples of sequence problems and show that evolution says this certain thing appeared here, but the Bible says this appeared first. And there are lots of sequence problems. So if you didn't have the time problem, you would still certainly have to deal with the sequence problem. But generally speaking, the time problem is what most people focus their attention on. Now, here's something else that's interesting. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, the Bible explains to us that God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons, for days and for years." Now, if a day is billions of years, what's a year? You see, you're running into some problems there. Now, somebody says, "Well, hold on, Kyle. You couldn't have a day that's 24 hours before you had the sun. And so somehow, all of those things that happened on day 1, day 2, day 3, they had to be different than what happened on days 4, 5, and 6 because you didn't have the sun to make the days." Well, hold on just a second. Does the sun make a day, or does the sun mark a day? What makes a day? You see, you've got the earth, it's a sphere. It's sitting at about 23.5 degrees angled on its axis. And a day is defined as one full rotation of the earth on its axis. Do you have to have the sun for the earth to have one full rotation on its axis? No, you do not. In fact, if you're looking at this situation, maybe you have come to the conclusion there that you've got another sequence problem. According to the Big Bang idea, where the universe exploded from a tiny ball of matter and then the earth somehow came along later, according to your standard evolutionary teaching, which came first, the sun or the earth? Well, the sun came first, certainly. It was the star that all the planets started coalescing out of space dust around, according to Genesis chapter 1, which came first, the earth or the sun. You see, in Genesis chapter 1, you have God creating the earth first, and the sun and the stars were not created until the fourth day. Well, if you're going to go to the standard materialistic, atheistic, evolutionary scenario, all the stars were supposed to have pre-existed the earth by billions of years, and yet according to Genesis chapter 1, God created the earth first, and the sun, moon, and stars on day 4. And there again, our time factor here. If God knows how to communicate the difference between a day and a year, and He goes in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, and says that the sun, moon, and stars are to mark the days and the years, there again, you can see that He's making a distinction between some time periods. What time periods? Days and years. Just exactly like we would discuss. Now, if we were to look at this statement, I think this is probably one of the most powerful. As you read it, you can see that we have failed to find a single example of the use of the word day in the entire Scripture where it means anything other than 24 hours when it's modified by a numeric adjective. Now, you've got the entire Bible, 39 books in the Old Testament. You can look through it and search for a single exception to this, and there's not one. Every single time the word day, yom, we would just spell it Y-O-M, every time that's used with a numeric adjective, it always means a literal 24-hour period. God separated light from the dark, and the darkness He called night, the light He called day, an evening and a morning, day one. God made the firmament an evening and a morning, day two. flowers, grass, and trees, evening and a morning, day three. Every single one of the days in Genesis chapter 1 are modified by a numeric adjective, and we don't have an example in all of Hebrew literature in the Old Testament that would say that you could have anything other than a literal 24-hour day there. Now, you following what I'm telling you? Okay, yeah, the word day could mean the opposite of night. The word day could mean an unidentified time in the future. The word day, but if you wanted to make it mean 24 hours, if that's what your intent was, how would you do that? Well, number one, you put evening and morning on it. Number two, you put it in contrast to the phrase years, or the term years in Genesis 1:14. Number three, you modify it by a numeric adjective. You're starting to see that Moses has done everything he could to help us understand these were literal 24-hour periods. And as we continue, the plural of the word yom appears over 700 times in the Bible. In non-prophetic literature, it always means a literal 24-hour period. Do we have an example where the days of creation are discussed in their plural form, yamim? Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, if you were to go to Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 through 11, you would read, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. For in 6 days," in six what? Days. Is that plural or singular? Plural. Is there a single example out of 700 instances in non-prophetic literature, is there a single example where that days means anything other than a literal 24-hour time period? Not one. In 6 days, the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. You say, Kyle, I mean, why is this important? Why are you spending an entire class on a Sunday morning? You've traveled here from the great state of Alabama, and now you're in Texas. Why are you spending an hour dealing with whether the word day means a literal 24-hour period? And here's why. Let me tell you why. I'm firmly convinced that God put a message in the Bible for us to get out, and that it is our job to get the message out of the Bible that God put into it, and not to find a message somewhere else and try to force that into the Bible. What I have seen happen is people have gone to the secular, popular, atheistic, evolutionary, scientific community. Now, the reason I always qualify atheistic, evolutionary, scientific community is because I know a host of people that are strong, excellent scientists that are not atheistic and they're not evolutionary. I got a guy that works with us right now. He's got a PhD from thermodynamics from Auburn University. Another guy writes with us. He's got a PhD from MIT in aeronautic engineering. He works over at NASA. Another guy that works with me by the name of Jerry Fowles. He writes for us. He's got a PhD in, what's his in? I don't know, something I don't even know if I can pronounce right. We've got a list of 3,000 scientists with graduate or PhD degrees that would suggest and say, yes, there's not a single scientific piece of information that goes against the idea that the world was created by God a few thousand years ago. So I always qualify it. But what has happened is there has been a bandwagon push for everybody to jump on the materialistic evolutionary idea. And many people who are Christians have been persuaded by that. And at their places of employment where smart people who believe in evolution are, they want to be able to say, well, yes, I believe in evolution. But then when they go to church and someone says, do you believe that God created the world? They want to be able to say, well, yes, I believe God created the world. And so to do that, lots of times what they will do is take information from the evolutionary teaching, and they will try to shove it into the Bible text. I'll tell you what it reminds me of. I don't know if you ever saw the old cartoon Cinderella, where the sisters were trying to try on the glass slipper. You remember that big, honking, ugly foot from like the stepsister that she was trying to shove in? When I was a little kid, what I thought was that glass slipper is going to break. Her foot is not going to fit in there. That slipper is going to break because it doesn't fit. My simple question would be, where is anybody getting the idea that there are billions of years of time? Or maybe a better question would be, where are they not getting it? You're not getting it from the Bible and extrapolating it out. You're getting it from somewhere else and trying to shove it in. Because if you're reading a straightforward Genesis and Exodus, well, God has done every single thing that He could, grammatically speaking, to make it so that you understand these days to be literal 24 hours. You say, well, hold on just a second, Kyle. That God could have done it any way He wanted. If God wanted to create the world in 6 billion years, He could have. That's true. He could have created 60 billion. I don't care how long God could have created the world, because He could have taken as long as He wanted. Could He have done it in 6 seconds? Could He have done it in 6 nanoseconds? You ever stop to ask yourself why in the world the Bible says He did it in 6 days? If God wanted to create the world in a single breath, He could have. So it's not like I'm trying to limit God and saying, no, God couldn't have done it in 60 billion years. He could have if He wanted. Or 6 seconds. I would probably, if I were going to argue for, if I just thought of a way God would do it, I would think He would just do it in one statement. Okay, boom, everything happens. That's not what He did though, is it? So there's got to be a reason why God is telling us He did it in 6 days. Now the verse on the screen is going to give you the reason. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the seas, and all that's in them, and ceased His creative activity on the 7th day. Now, this is just an aside, just for your information. That word rested on the 7th, that word rested simply means stopping. Stopping creative activity. Like the word arrested, if you arrest someone from making progress in a race, that means you stop them. Same word that you're looking at there in Hebrew, it doesn't mean God got tired and He was just worn out and by the 6th day He needed a break and sit down on a lazy boy and drink him a glass of sweet tea. That is not the picture here of God. God ceases creative activity on day 7. Why? Simple. From the dawn of human history, a week has been 7 days. Now, when the Jews heard Moses' statement, for in 6 days you shall work. For 6 days you shall work. What did they understand those periods of 6 days to mean? 6 long extended periods of millions of years? That was going to be rough for them, wouldn't it? I think I might talk to the union, see if we could work another contract on that. What, one long extended period of millions of years you rest? No, the Jews understood this perfectly. They understood when Moses said this, what he meant was God took 6 literal 24 hours to create everything. He stopped creating on one literal 24-hour period, and that is the pattern for our work week. Do you know that there's not a physical phenomena in the world, in the universe, to anybody's knowledge, that gives you a 7-day week? Now, you want a year? You can get a year. What's a year? One elliptical orbit of the earth around the sun? That's a year. Where do we get that? From the physical phenomena of the earth going around the sun. You want a day? Okay, we got that. Where do you get a day? The physical phenomena of the earth rotating on its axis. Where do you get a 7-day week? Nowhere. Did you know that some people have tried to change the 7-day week? If I understand it correctly, in China at one period in their history, they thought, why 7 days? This doesn't make any sense. I think China tried to change it to 8 days. I think it was Russia years and years ago. I'm talking about hundreds of years ago. And they tried to change it to 10 days, all with horrible consequences as far as it never got off the ground, and they all went back to a 7-day week. Why? Why has every single culture from the dawn of human history had a 7-day week? There's only one explanation for that. That is exactly how God established it on the first week of creation. And it makes perfect sense when you tie that in to Exodus chapter 20, verse 8. If that weren't the case, what in the world is God trying to say in Exodus 20, verse 8? What He is saying is very clear. Here is what I want you to do for your week. I took 6 literal 24-hour periods to make the world, and I rested 1 literal 24-hour period. I want you to work for 6 literal 24-hour periods, and I want you to rest for 1 literal 24-hour period. Now, is that as clear as a bell to anybody that honestly is assessing this passage? It seems like it should be to me. There's nothing hard about that. You're not trying to shove something into the text that's not there. There's something else I think that is worth noting in this regard. How long has man been on the scene? Well, when you start looking at Jesus' explanation in Mark chapter 10, the people came to Jesus talking about marriage and divorce, and he was defining marriage for them. And he said, from the beginning, God created them male and female, and said, and explained there about marriage. When did God create man? From the beginning. In fact, if you would go to Romans chapter 1, verse 20, you would see that from the beginning of creation, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made. That word seen and understood, what do those words mean? Human witnessing and understanding. That's what they mean. So from the beginning of creation, God's invisible attributes are seen by who? By man. From the beginning, what does that mean? Let me explain to you this. If you were to take an evolutionary scenario, a theistic evolutionary scenario, and if my outstretched arms represented the 13.7 billion years of time that is supposedly available, then right here, my longest finger on my right hand would be the beginning of the 13.7 billion years. And so then you would have about right here, you'd have 13.5 billion. About right here, you'd have, oh, we're down to 12 billion. About right here, you'd have 6 billion. Over here would be the very end of time. My longest finger on my left hand. So 13.7 starts over here. Over here on my left hand is the end of time. Do you know when, according to the evolutionary scenario, humans arrived on the scene? Well, it's not my wrist over here on my right hand. It's not my shoulder. Not at my head. It's not even over here on this. Humans arrived on the scene, according to the evolutionary scenario, at the very tip of my longest finger on my left hand, with a tiny fraction of an inch left to go in what would be the history of the universe. So, according to the evolutionary time frame, you've got 13.7 billion starting over here, and you don't have humans coming onto the scene until about 6 million years ago, which is the tiniest tip of a fragment of my finger over here on my left hand. Would you consider that from the beginning? I'm just wondering. From the beginning is going to have to be something very different than separated from the beginning by 13.6999 billion years. And what do we see? Well, what we see, according to Genesis chapter 1, is that on day 6, God created Adam and Eve. From the very first week of creation, you have humans on the scene there to see, witness, and understand God's invisible attributes. So, according to the Bible, you have Jesus stating that mankind came from the beginning. But according to the theistic evolution model, you have to say humans didn't arrive on the scene until 6 million years ago, which would only be a tiny fraction of the history of the universe. So now the simple question would be, if you were going to look at this scenario, can we insert the billions of years of time needed after creation? You say, all right, Kyle, well, it doesn't really fit in the creation. Let's try to put it after creation. Well, I'm going to show you that that's going to be problematic for you. And here's why. The Bible gives us... What time does this class get over? It's over? Is that what you're telling me here? Once I start seeing people pulling up in the back in the foyer, that means that... So is this 9:15? Is that what time it really gets over? Yeah? All right, well... All right, okay, you want to know this piece of information. I'm just going to give you the quick version, and here it is. You can't put it after the creation because from us to Jesus has been about how long? 2,000 years. From Jesus to Abraham has been about how long? 2,000 years. Everybody recognizes that. In fact, secular, you don't even have to talk to anybody who's religious to get those two figures. 2,000 years from us to Jesus, 2,000 years from Jesus to Abraham. The only thing we've got to determine then is, how long was it from Abraham to Adam? Well, do you know that if you were to calculate that statement up from Abraham to Adam, you would get, it was 55 generations from Jesus to Abraham. It was 20 generations from Abraham to Adam. You go to Genesis chapter 5 and it starts telling you the ages of the fathers when they had the sons. Adam was 130 years when he had his son Seth. Seth was, and it gives you the ages. You start calculating that up, guess what you got? You've got approximately 2,000 years from Abraham to Adam. So that gives you approximately 6,000 years for the age of the earth. And some people say, well, Kyle, aren't there all kinds of scientific dating methods? No, actually, there are over 100 scientific dating methods, and about 75 of those give you a young Earth in a few thousand years. So if we were just to say, does science defeat or hurt or give you information that says this 6,000-year period, approximate 6,000 years, couldn't work? No. No, it certainly doesn't. And the Bible presents a very clear picture. In 6 days, God created the world, and that was six literal 24-hour days, and it fits perfectly with everything we know to be scientific. Thank you very much. Sorry to take you over.